The OTV Sports app. Listen, watch, read, all in one place. Wherever you are, we're always with you. The OTV Sports app. Available to download now from your app store. The OTB Podcast Network.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Now, something a bit different for you on tonight's Wednesday Night Rugby, which is brought to you with thanks to Vodafone. We recorded a chat with Paul O'Connell and Tyke Furlong yesterday as part of a Vodafone staff event, largely a Lions focus to it. We'll bring you that very, very shortly. The lads in good form. But first, what didn't come up so much with the lads yesterday, the Tyke Furlong contract situation. He was talking to the media at large about that yesterday. So it's a one-year deal, as you know. Struck a lot of people as being on the short side and also agreed quite late in the season. So he addressed firstly here why it took so long, quite a protracted negotiation.
I suppose there's a delay in the start of negotiations really across the board because of the situation we're in. And then I was coming back from long-term injury. I want to get back playing. And when you're playing big game weeks, you don't want to be talking contracts. So it probably all added into it, you know.
And in terms of the injury, I mean, David mentioned that in his statement. I mean, was that a big sticking point in terms of you guys trying to get what you wanted from the deal?
I don't think it was a sticking point or wasn't overly talked about, really. It probably delayed the start of it as much on my side as Anthon, where, you know, you have a bank of work in front of you and you just want no distractions and you want to get out there and get back playing. And when you do get back playing, you want to... I suppose in big game weeks you don't want that in your head other than playing a bit of ball. So yeah, look, I suppose the 1 year deal probably suited me best for a number of reasons really, but what I would say is, you know, I'm very happy where I am playing rugby. I'm very happy in Leinster, I'm very happy in Ireland, I'm well looked after in terms of, you know, not only game management but like relationship with physios, coaches, how we want to play. You know, there's a good group of us now who kind of came through the academy together, and we're going to kind of get that to that 27 to 29, 30 age bracket. So, look, I'm very happy where I am. I signed a year because it kind of suited me more than Anthon, really, and see where we are again next year. Yeah, well, like a lot of lads have signed 1 year deals in, you know, the current term, and it's no different for them either, you know what I mean? And, look, I suppose there is the element of risk in it from my point of view in terms of injury or selection or performance, etc. But I suppose you just have to get on with it, don't you? And if you start thinking like that, you're in trouble.
Can I just confirm that there was the offer of more than 1 year on the table for you?
There was the offer of more than 1 year on the table.
Yeah.
There you are. So some of Tyke Furlong addressing the contract situation yesterday, hopefully in a year's time or less. He's announcing a 3-4-5 year deal, anything he wants, and he's around for a long time to come. So we'll dive into the chat here with Paul O'Connell, Tyke Furlong yesterday, largely Lions focused this one.
Fellas, you're both welcome. I'm sure everybody tuning in knows the general deal here, certainly from a Lions perspective. We have Paul O'Connell, who has been on three tours, captain in 09, he was there in 05 and 13 as well, and Tyke Furlong heading off on his second tour, which is great. Tyke, where did you watch the announcement?
I watched it in the hotel. We're still in quarantine, so kind of on your own. So it was nerve-wracking. God, I was nervous.
Would you stop? You were not nervous. You knew damn well you were going. Come off that now.
No, genuine now. Joey, boy, don't be tempting fate with me here. Yeah, so I had a thing all along. It's like, I'm watching this and next... The last time in 2017, we were in training, you see. So lads were chatting. You only got in to see the names even read out. But I was in for the whole build-up this time. And just the longer it went on, I was thinking to myself, no, if my name comes out here, I'm coming out after Toby Faletau. So I was watching it, and Toby Faletau comes out. And then Xander Fagerson came out. And just for, you know, those 10 seconds before I was next, I was bricking it. So... I was absolutely over the moon. Yeah, delighted.
I'm sure you saw Kyle Sinclair's interview over the weekend. I mean, that's the other side. It is horrific if you don't get that call.
Yeah, and you feel for him. You know, I suppose he was very honest in how he felt, and he had his emotions out there. And look, I don't pick teams, but you still have a bit of empathy and feel a bit sorry for those who don't get picked, you know.
Mm. Paul O'Connell, you're looking at this squad that Gatland has picked. What clues does it give you as to how he's going to go about his business against South Africa? What jumps out to you about this squad and the makeup of it?
I don't know. It's very hard to tell. He's obviously picked some big men, which Gatland always does. And you probably need them against South Africa as well. I would imagine that they won't play a lot different to what they did in the World Cup. You know, Razzie has a formula that he sticks to. It generally revolves around territory. He's not too bothered about possession. You know, the less possession he has, really, the better for him in some regards. Line out, maul, scrum. You know, he wants less rucks than the opposition. He wants to make more tackles than the opposition. And he wants a really long kicking game. So I don't think he's going to move away from that, particularly when you look at the success they had in it in the World Cup. So he's trying to pick a team, I presume, to prepare for that. And they nearly got all of those things right when Wales played them in the World Cup. I think the only one they might have lost is Razzie is big into turnovers conceded as well. And I think that's the only one Wales lost in that game. They conceded a maul penalty late in the game as well, which South Africa kicked. And that was the 3 points that won them the game. So it's about trying to play his own game, but also I think trying to stop what South Africa are doing as well. So it's going to be tricky. And I suppose one of the things you look at when you look at the squad, you kind of, there's a few strange selections, but you know, you kind of, I suppose he's very experienced as a coach. He's very experienced as a Lions coach, and I'm sure he has a strategy in mind with the selections.
Yeah. He has a habit of being vindicated by his after with his stranger selections in time, you know, gets criticism up front and then is sitting pretty at the end.
Yeah, I think he makes a decision and he backs someone to do something and he backs them so much that, you know, very often it works out. So
yeah.
It's tough. It's tough for some of the Irish guys that have been left out and it's disappointing for them, you know. It's going to be a very tough tour. The way they're kind of going to be in a bit of a quarantine, the way there isn't going to be a lot of outside the hotel, even the way, you know, I only noticed a few days ago, there's no midweek games in the last 4 weeks of the tour. So there's going to be a lot of players that actually aren't going to be, you know, they might play a game on July 14th and the last game is on August 7th. They may not be involved again. And it's a tough station. And some guys, you know, as happy as some of the tours that I've been on have been, some guys haven't coped well with not being picked.
That could be tough. There could be a lot of room service and sitting in your hotel room those last 4 weeks for lads.
Yeah, listen, I'm sure the guys will, you know, come up with something to make it an entertaining and fun tour. You know, you need characters to do that, but it is going to be tough. Everyone going there is used to being picked all their lives. You know, they're used to being first choice all their lives almost. So those last 4 weeks are going to be a real challenge for 15 or 16 guys on that tour.
Yeah, I can imagine. Tyke, how did you find 2017 and the length of the tour and the intensity of the tour? I remember quite well talking to you shortly afterwards, and I think you were sort of saying, geez, I wasn't too sorry to get home and get a bit of my own company and my own personal space for a while. You know, like you're fairly locked in there, and that'll be even more the case this time around. How did you find 17?
Yeah, like initially at the time, it's tough work. Like I'm sure Paul would agree, you're going for it from the moment you get up out there, obviously, because you want to make an impression in training. Every game is like the biggest game of your life because you're trying to reach the pinnacle of getting picked for a test game. So the pressure and the physical aspect of it is tough. But it's only when you look back on it, you kind of say, it's class. I want to go on another one. And it's kind of that materializes over time. I think everyone's just raring to go for it.
What was COVID life like in the Six Nations? Was it, once you got in the bubble, was it pretty normal, or was it, I was hearing things like you were almost encouraged not to hang out with people in the same position as you, so you wouldn't take down, you know, so one prop wouldn't take down all the props kind of thing. Was all that stuff part of life?
Yeah, I suppose it was a new normal for us for that period, really. And we just had to do, I know it sounds awful to say this, but the players just had to do what they were told, really, in some respects, of where to sit and, you know, the table seating plan. And but, you know, we were still lucky that we had that social aspect where a lot of people didn't have. You know, you could still talk to people. We're very lucky that way, and to get out and about and still, you know, live our life as normally as we could under circumstances, I suppose.
Yeah. So who would you sit beside, the same people every day type thing?
Yeah, we kind of did it in rotations for a week. I suppose, I think Ger Carmody came up with it, the table seating plan, and Jerby very organised now in Ireland. And so try to mix it up, but very rarely in the same position as you, just in case someone came down, you'd be all close contacts and just you wouldn't have a tie head.
Yeah. Did it affect preparation on the field, Paul? Like, were you limited in what you could do at scrum time or things like that? Or once you're on the training field, were all bets off?
No, we weren't limited in terms of how we trained. We were probably limited in terms of the meetings we could have and where we could have meetings. So we met in the indoor pitch quite a lot with a TV where we had guys, you know, it's a big open air facility. It was quite hard to communicate to the big group. You know, guys weren't seated, so it was probably a little bit more difficult to take notes or whatever. So the meetings were a little bit more challenging, but from a training point of view, we were fine. You know, we were able to train as much as we would have done previously. We were able to do walkthroughs as much as the guys would have done previously. So that wasn't a challenge. But, you know, I think the thing about eating is, you know, we're at three at a table. And I suppose there was maybe, I don't know, maybe 25 tables in the dining room. And if there was eight of you eating and none of you were at the same table, you just hear the clicking of forks on the plates because you couldn't really chat. And that is the challenge, because, you know, you want guys to be able to sit down and relax with one another and chat about everyday things, but you want them chatting about the game and little things from training as well. And maybe that didn't happen as much, but I think the players made a great fist of it, because it certainly wasn't easy. It was very challenging. We couldn't do a lot of the things that Andy would have liked to have done in terms of lightening the mood and in terms of helping players switch off. So players were incredible, and you know, it showed in terms of how they played so well at the end of the tournament after 6 or 7 weeks in that type of atmosphere. It was a real credit to them.
Yeah, that mingling, that's essential with the Lions, really, isn't it? Getting to know fellas over a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, one of the things, you know, Clive tried to copy things from England in 2005. So we had a team room separate to where we ate, and we had an analysis room separate to that. And then we had a physio room separate to that. Whereas in 2009, I suppose we learned from that and we tried to do everything in one room. So it was actually quite hard to get hotels. So, you know, you could be doing analysis 6 feet away, someone could be getting a massage, and 10 feet away, someone could be eating their dinner. Like, we were just trying to spend as much time together as possible. And it really helped the tour, because, you know, you just don't have time. You need to take every opportunity to get to know one another. And I don't know if they're going to be able to do that on this tour. You know, even in 2009 in Johannesburg, we had a small outdoor area. I remember they moved in three big jacuzzis out there, and Craig White wanted guys, you know, he was big into sleep at the time, which, you know, every S&C coach is into now, but he wanted guys in there before they went to bed in the evening. So you could come down some evenings at 10 o'clock, there'd be 15 or 16 guys in jacuzzis out the back, just chatting, and the heat helps you sleep or whatever. But you'd imagine those things, those little tricks that they were doing to get people to spend time together, you'd imagine the Lions aren't going to be able to do that. And it's different with Ireland. Guys know each other already. They don't need to spend the time investing in each other, whereas on a Lions tour you really do need to do it.
Yeah, all of those things you describe are almost the opposite of COVID protocol, really, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. The South African props then, Tig, I'm curious, what kind of challenge do they pose? Do they scrummage in a certain way? Obviously, they're all big men. What's that going to be like?
Yeah, aggressive, I would have said. You know, it's hard to look at them because they haven't played a game since the World Cup, really, as a unit. But I think everyone's overriding memory from the World Cup is, you know, that scrum dominance. And I suppose that's a thing in all aspects of their forward play, be it maul, line out defence, ruck, carry, scrum. They're always just looking for those little one-ups on you where they can maybe eke a penalty and gain a little bit of possession and territory, and then they go at you again. So, you know, I think everyone knows they're huge men and they're very, very aggressive. So, you know, it's such a pivotal part of the game for them and such a strength. Mm. So, you know, there's massive challenges there for us.
Yeah. You must have come up against them a few times. How have you got on generally?
Again, it's a good while ago and it was under different management, really. So I would have toured there in 2016, where Rossi started the first and third test and I started the second one. We played in my home then the following November or November after. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Mm. You know, but again, sport changes, rugby's changing, their team has changed, different personnel, different coaching, different emphasis on stuff.
And, yes.
You know, I think it'd be very interesting to get a read of, you know, some of the English players who've worked with Matthew Proudfoot, who was their scrum coach in the World Cup, and just to pick their brains a little bit about what he tried to implement with England, what he learned from the World Cup, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's something to look forward to.
Yeah, for sure. So at this stage, you would be pretty experienced, I think. I know props can mature that bit later and they have to catalogue a lot of experiences in the scrum to really hit their peak. Generally, at this stage, you're not coming up against anything you haven't seen before when it comes to scrummaging, are you? You must be rare you're in a scrum going, geez, I haven't felt this before. What's going on here? Do you generally now have a good feel for everything they're throwing at you?
No, I wouldn't say everything. I think in scrummage, a lot of time it's about trying to get your cohesion right as a front three and a front five and an eight. So you feel comfortable because in your own, looking after your own bits first, where you know the connections are strong, you're all on the same page. And then it's opposition and what they're doing. And look, I always say that I can't see what you see on the television when I'm actually in a scrum. I can only remember what it felt like. And then I have to match up with the feeling with the picture afterwards, if that makes sense. And
yeah,
I suppose as people used to always say to me, it used to frustrate the life out of me when I was younger that, you know, it's experience, time in the saddle. But I suppose as you maybe get on a little bit, you do understand that a little bit more and how to problem solve within that and matching that feeling to the picture you see on the outside in game or in training or what have you. And coming up with a solution to the problem.
Mm. Half time must be crucial then these days with video analysis. You can get in, have a look at this, see what he's doing, get a few overhead shots and maybe sort something out for the second half. Is that a bigger part maybe of the game than 10, 15 years ago?
I didn't play 10 or 15 years ago.
Back in the old days when O'Connell played,
A lot of time it's just a calm chat. What are you feeling?
Right.
What can we get better at? Can we have some one or two key points that we need to get better at or we need to keep our foot down on top of? And if you can get a sneak peek of the video, especially overheads are gold in scrummaging terms. And you get in the Millennium Stadium, you get in Twickenham and stuff like that. So if you get those at halftime, it shows a really, really good picture of what actually is happening in the scrum.
Yeah. Where does the second row come into all that, Paul? Would you just put your head down and push, do you? Or were you doing analysis too?
Yeah, we definitely used to put our head down and push, and it wasn't that technical, but it got very technical towards the end of my time. I think Greg Feek was the first guy to really put a massive emphasis on the back five scrummaging. He was the first guy to ever come to training with a telescopic pole with a tiny little GoPro on the top of it, and he'd have a video analyst behind the scrum, videoing the scrum from on high in training. He was the first guy to ever do that. And if you can see the grass through any few little, you know, gaps in joints, you know you have a problem. And I would have definitely been experiencing a bit of that, you know, when a prop goes to hit a scrum and he leaves, and if you don't leave the station with him as a second row, there's a little cavity there for a split second. And the GoPro with the telescopic camera over training was the first time we ever really properly saw that. We'd been videoing training probably from both sides of the scrum for a long time. And Greg Feek used to be very, very calm in training. He was very different to a lot of the other coaches. He'd, you know, we might only do 8 or 9 scrums in training, which is probably standard now, but back then it was a big deal. You know, you could be over there hitting the machine for a half an hour in the earlier days. And then you go back in and look at the footage and you just correct what you'd seen. So I actually got moved across the scrum in 2009. I got moved from the tight head side to the loose head side because they wanted a bit more weight on the tight head side. And I kind of, after that, I started really kind of addressing how I scrummaged, because I was only ever about 112 kilos. I was never going to be, you know, I was never going to be Simon Shaw's weight or Donnie O'Callaghan's kind of weight. So you had to try and be technically good in the second row. And I enjoyed that journey actually with Greg Feek, because it's the same then in the line out. You know, you're relying heavily on props and their lift quality, you're relying hookers on their throwing quality. So you have to invest the same thing in the second row in terms of your scrummaging ability to make them look good.
I suspect, Paul, you've reflected on the Six Nations in depth on how you did yourself. Give us something you felt happy enough with that you think, okay, I did a decent job there. I made a bit of an impact on that front. I know, don't give me faux humility here. And something that you didn't, that actually you thought, God, I need to get better at that. You know, this coaching lark, Six Nations campaign, I'm going to need to improve that aspect of my performance. So give us one of each, maybe. What do you feel you did okay at?
Trying to stay out of the player's way is the important thing. Boys are at the front line all the time, every single week, you know, whether they're playing derbies with their provinces or big European games. They're the guys that are at the front line and learning what is cutting edge, you know. So we're actually, when we're watching footage all the time while we're out of camp, we're trying to keep up with them. So you're just trying to find out what they feel works best and trying to facilitate that, I suppose. And I tried to do that as much as I could, try and stay out of the smart guy's way and try and facilitate them to do what they're good at. It's probably different in a club where you have a mixture of, I suppose, playing abilities and playing levels. You've guys coming out of academies. You might even have a few academy players training with you to seasoned internationals. And you've guys that need to do a whole lot of work. You've guys that need to do less work and need to be looked after. But with Ireland, you're dealing with very smart, very motivated players, and you're just trying to facilitate them and not break them in training, I suppose, as well, is an important part.
Mm. And if there's one thing that you would like to improve on, if you felt, oh, I could get better at that, this will be a longer answer, I guess, knowing you.
You'd like to get more done with less time, you know, and that's one of the things I would have learned, even with Warren Gatland when we were on the Lions. I remember we had a meeting one day and I'd sat down with Graham Rowntree and we picked out 11 clips that we felt we needed to show around the line out. And he went up and he showed three of them. And afterwards I said to him, you left out a load of the detail. I said, how come you only showed three clips? He said, Gats just came up to me and asked me what I was showing beforehand. And he told him, look, you can show him three of them. That's all you're allowed to do. And Gats is big into making coaches prioritize, because the more time you're given, the more time you lose. You know, yeah. every coach I speak to wants more time, but it really makes you prioritize what you're doing. And and that's what I'd probably like to be better at what I'm doing with less time.
Yes, you probably wanted 111 clips, did you really, if you're being honest?
Yeah, well, look, it doesn't land then, you know. I mean,
yes,
again, on the Lions tour, Sean Edwards, he'd get up and he'd present for 3.5 minutes, and it would be absolute box office.
Yeah.
You know, you'd 100% understand what he wanted you to do. A very simple plan, a few things that he felt were really, really important, and he left you in no doubt. And, you know, he didn't need 30 minutes of a meeting to do it. He could do it in 3 minutes, 4 minutes. He could do it with two clips. And they'd always be judging the players, judging, you know, where are they, you know, in terms of their motivation for what we're doing, or how tired are they, or did we travel yesterday? And he's good at that, Sean Edwards, and Warren Gatland is good at it as well. And I think that's why Gatland is suited to the Lions in many ways.
Yes. Tyke, how are you on that front when it comes to meeting after meeting and detail after detail? Do you prefer the less is more approach, or do you like hoovering it all up?
Look, I suppose it depends on what's been said, really, and how specific or how much you want to take in. I suppose as Irish players, we were nearly conditioned to sit in meetings and take in a lot of information. And but I suppose, look, times are changing in terms of that, definitely for the national team. And I suppose the emphasis has changed on to getting out to train and putting into practice and not to overthink it, really. So I suppose you're well able to adapt and do both, really, because we're used to both, really. Mm. It was definitely a shock, maybe the last Lions tour, with how little we did, and it's like, are we prepared? You know, because it's all new to you. Like, are we ready to go here? Lads, no, we switched on. But I suppose the emphasis comes on the player then to do a lot more himself if you're that way inclined, you know?
Okay, interesting. I'm sure La Rochelle is still stinging. Your thoughts on the game, the big reason you felt you left it behind?
I don't. The big reason we didn't perform well enough on the day, and it hurts. It was a sad dressing room, and because it means a lot to us, you know. We put a lot in there for the game. We also over the last number of years, really, and I suppose fall at a semi-final stage this year, after falling at a quarter final stage, after falling at a final the year before. You know, when you're thereabouts, the game's decided on small margins, and to be fair to La Rochelle, they deserved their victory.
Yeah. And did you feel it was just small little things? Is that generally what it comes down to? It's how people are trying to draw parallels or similarities with the two Saracens games as well. Like, power has been talked about. I don't know to what extent you think that's a fair point or wide of the mark.
A little bit. Look, it's like scrummage, you say, where we talk about all these technical details, but underpinned by all of it, there has to be a bit of will and want and a sharp shoulder in there. And we probably came off second best. I don't think we're absolutely destroyed by any matter of means in terms of physicality, but, you know, some of our ruck work obviously let us down. And, you know, day one collisions in attack. And, you know, we had such a good start to lead them back in, and, you know, it hurts.
Yeah. What tends to dictate who wins collisions?
Oh, like, you're opening a can of worms there.
Am I? Right, okay.
Size, like, it depends on which way you're playing. It's your running lines, your change up onto the ball, footwork at the line, sheer physical size is obviously a big one as well, speed of ruck ball. There's so much single versus two-man hits. You know, it all feeds into it. It's like, you can't just put your hanger hat on one thing.
Okay. Paul, what did you make of it? Obviously, I'm sure you're watching Ron Nogara with interest as well.
Yeah. It was a great performance from La Rochelle. And they're an interesting team. They know exactly what they're doing. You know, the reason I would have watched a lot of La Rochelle is they have this very interesting style of maul defence, which Donica Ryan would have rang me about 4 months ago when they played against them with Racing, and they all stand at the back of the line out and dare you to throw it to the back, and that's where they defend. And if you throw it to the front and try and maul, they just spin the back of your maul, and it's very bordering on illegal. But because of that, they've defended really well. Their maul defence has been excellent all year. And if you throw it off the top, because all their guys are standing at the back, they generally get their fold right and they put you under pressure. So they do some things very well. They kick a lot and then they offload a lot as well. They kick the most, I think, of anyone, and they offload the most of anyone. So they've got a great balance between being, very strict in how they play and not giving you any chances. And then when they have a crack off you, they're not afraid to offload and take a few risks as well. So, and that would have been a massive game for them, that Leinster game. And I think even going 7-0 behind in the early few minutes and being dominated as much as they were in the first few minutes, it would have feared them up even more. Mm. Probably similar to what happened to Leinster in the first game against Exeter, in the quarterfinal against Exeter, that, you know, Leinster realised now they needed to play the game of their lives to win, and they did. And La Rochelle probably realises they need to play their game of their lives when they went 7-0 down and were being completely dominated and couldn't get out of their half, and they managed to as well. So it is fine margins, but they know what they stand for, and they're very good at recruiting for it, and they're very good at sticking to their game plan.
Very interesting. Fellas, the clock's against us. Paul, thanks very much for that. Great to chat to you. And Ty, very best of luck over the summer. We'll all be watching. Hope it all goes well out there for you.
No worries. Thanks, Joe.
Wednesday night rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.